mundo.
Hello, dear listener of the Gestalten Podcast. My name is Martin Groschwald, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of this absolutely fantastic recording of the transportation design or creative design world. And in this week's episode, I had the pleasure to welcome Jeremy Offen, who is the chief design officer for a lovely little company called Arrival. And you might have heard of Arrival before. They have done a pretty nicely looking bus and also a van that had quite a lot of, you know, caught up quite a lot of steer in the industry, but also overall. They got quite a lot of investment from companies such as Hyundai, but also from companies such as BlackRock, if people are familiar with them. So they have become quite a big deal in this kind of new mobility generation that's happening right now. And Jeremy, interestingly, is not coming from a transportation design background. He's more of industrial design, a lot of experience and service design background. And we sat down a little bit to understand what his background is, how his background helps him also to work for a company such as Arrival, how Arrival is run, the importance of also the CEO, who's a massive influence on also Jeremy and how he thinks design is run, which was extremely interesting. And I think we never had any, you know, insights like this into a company, especially that young, such as Arrival. So enjoy the conversation, enjoy everything that Jeremy has had to say and my few questions that came with that. And we will, of course, link his LinkedIn into the subscription as well as we talked a little bit about Dieter Rams, as well as the documentary on Dieter Rams by Gary Huswood. So enjoy this conversation with Jeremy and myself, Martin Groschwald. Jeremy, welcome to the Gestalten Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on board. And first of all, I hope you're doing well.
Yeah, very well. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much for joining us. And we want to talk a little bit about something that has been around for, I think, 4 years now and has made quite a bit of waves over the past few months and few years through, you know, products that you guys have developed, but also investments that you guys got. We want to talk a little bit about Arrival. But before I want to start talking about Arrival, I want to talk a little bit about you, because you're the CDO, so the chief design officer. But when people, I think, in the media look at Arrival, they see your bus, they see your commercial vehicles. But from everything that I do understand, is you're not the traditional car designer in that kind of sense. What's, if you can give a little bit of a background and how you fell into Arrival, yeah, with, you know, this kind of car commercial vehicle business, I think that would help us a little bit, because that would give us a good idea also how Arrival works.
Sure. Well, as you rightly say, I'm not automotive design trained. My background is industrial design consulting. It started, I guess, my career started at the back end of the 1980s, and I joined a fairly traditional industrial design consultancy, worked for them throughout the 90s, and into the 2000s, and then set up my own business. Latterly, I joined a company called Great Fridays as a design director, and that was a service design business. And one of their, I guess, missing parts of the jigsaw was the physical product. So they were very good on the kind of the digital and the service design aspects of their business, but not so much on the physical. So we really kind of combined all of those efforts together. And that led to an acquisition by an agency, a large consulting firm called EPAM, which is where I introduced ourselves really to Arrival and to Dennis, our CEO. And that was a bit of a meeting of minds, really. I think he was coming at the formation of Arrival really was less of an automotive company and more of a technology company that happened to be focused on mobility. And that was, I think, a key draw for me, that they weren't interested in, you know, I know it's a dirty word, but styling, you know, that wasn't part, wasn't part of the equation. And that, I think, is rightly or wrongly been what I guess a lot of the automotive design industry has been, that's the brush they've been tarred with. And I think that is now changing. Absolutely. I think there is now much more of a focus on the overall user experience. But 5 years ago, when I first met Dennis, and he'd already been to visit a lot of the kind of Italian design houses and some of the more traditional automotive routes, consultancies. And we were coming at it from a completely different perspective. So we were a service design business that happened to have physical product as part of our offering. And we approached it by looking at the requirements of Arrival's potential user base. Now, whether that be the driver, the operator, the passenger, the person who cleans the vehicle at the end of a shift, these were the sort of things that I was pitching that we would be considering as part of our consulting package, if you like. And I think that kind of struck a chord with Dennis. As I say, he didn't really see himself as a traditional automotive CEO. You know, that wasn't what he was about. He was looking for a sort of transformative approach to an industry that had been entrenched in tradition for 100 years. So actually coming at it from a different approach rather than an automotive design background, I think was something that resonated with him.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for me, from a little bit on the outside, what I always found fascinating about Arrival, but also the collaborations, of course, that you have. I mean, like Roborace is part in there, Charge Cars is part in there, and all these things. But it never really seemed that there is this kind of, you know, differentiation between the physical product design as well as the digital product design or the experience design in that kind of sense. Is my feeling right that this is the way how you want to handle it? And also, of course, how do you mix the two? Because I can imagine, of course, you will still need to have some kind of transportation designers to help you with the shapes. You will probably be working still with Alias modelers because that's how the surfacing is being built and all these things. But how do you mix that? Because that's always been the massive kind of issue of the traditional car industry. It's just like, you know, you have what you mentioned, of course, is the styling guys that are becoming much more involved into design nowadays because the user experience, the customer experience is coming more into that. So how do you deal with that? And obviously you have a little bit of a background, but how do you get your new guys coming into the business saying just like, look, we need to do things a little bit differently here?
I mean, you're right. I mean, the physical and the digital are absolutely intertwined. I often use the term, the physical product is the gateway, that is the portal to a wider software-based set of experiences. And that word experience design is the glue that holds it all together. So we approach everything, as I say, from the standpoint of the user, and then to kind of bolt on the various design disciplines that we require to facilitate the end result, whether that be industrial design, which I think industrial designers as part of our training, we kind of have a very lateral way of thinking about problems. So we really go back to the nub of the problem, the I guess in service design terms, all the sort of pain points, we start to identify all of those opportunities to improve a product and a service. And then latterly, we've kind of spun out our experience design team into a separate entity, very closely linked, obviously, with industrial design, but under our new CXO, Kwame Nyaning, who's come from McKinsey, so another consulting background. And together, and adding in, you know, user research and personas and service design protocols, we're able to really kind of frame the problem and then reframe the solution. So, and that is I absolutely entwined, as I say, between the physical and the digital products working seamlessly. I mean, Arrival is, I don't know what the actual percentage of is, but I think at one point we were sort of 70%. Software and 30% hardware. So the emphasis very much was on hardware enabled software services, and the physical product is at the heart of that.
Then let me ask you this kind of question. We've seen, of course, because you mentioned the software side, we've seen services such as Uber. We have Didi in China. Yeah, we have different kind of local solutions everywhere in the world that are solely based on, you know, this idea of an app or of a service that can be intertwined with another app or like with a service that a government offers in that kind of sense. What made you think in the sense of it's actually good for us to offer a product with our service rather than just a brain behind it, but we need actually, you know, the body as well, so that this makes, you know, the biggest sense? Because as soon as you go into something such as the complexity of a transportation vehicle, you know, doesn't matter if it's a van or a bus or a car or whatever, but the complexity is so big, even if you just want to transport something. What made you guys make that step of just like, okay, maybe it's the best to do that? Because that is a big pain that you guys build on there.
Yeah, and I think that realization has grown organically, shall we say, from the beginning of our journey together. But you know, it was always Dennis's vision that hardware was going to play an important part on this. I mean, we like tangible things. You know, we all, as human beings, we're drawn to those physical objects. I mean, it's, I guess if you go back to your school days, your parents have still probably got the little clay ashtray that you made when you were seven sitting on the
pretty much, yeah.
They probably haven't kept the maths equation that you did, you know. I think, as I say, as a human race, we're drawn to the tangible, the physical, and you know, we're not going to get from A to B with just software. You know, we're still very much about mobility. We're still about transporting people. But going back to that question of whether or not we, you know, see ourselves as an automotive company, we don't really. I mean, we've got more in common with, say, you know, your smartphone. And I guess in the case of the bus, it's more in common with architecture. You know, these are spaces for people to, you know, navigate through and to enjoy being in. It just so happens that they've got four wheels. You know, these are places of work for a lot of people. So understanding all of those requirements and designing that into the principles that, you know, baked in at the beginning of the design process was really key. But yeah, the physical product was never in question. That was always going to be at the heart of it.
In the build-up of the company and, you know, your teams, you just mentioned, like, you know, the experience team, or like the more digital side, and you split it up because of probably just the complexity that come with each kind of side. It's almost an impossible to do everything together in one group. It also comes a little bit with size. But how difficult is it, especially on the product side, on the physical product side, to find the people to, you know, think exactly what you just mentioned? Because, you know, if you look into the traditional transportation, and I'm not just talking about car, but I'm talking about aviation, you know, I'm talking about two wheelers and all these kind of things, there's still this kind of emotion of like freedom, you know, and what this product can be and how it can take you from A to B. Your point of view seems much more practical in that sense. And I would even say, like, you know, one can feel that you're coming not from this very emotional car design background, but maybe more from this very pragmatical product and industrial design background. How difficult is that to find the right people that can share that with you, especially if you do, in the end, what is still a vehicle and where a lot of probably, you know, applications come from the vehicle design industry?
I think the emotion, that kind of emotional draw for our designers comes from actually doing something that potentially could change the way that we live and change the way that we experience cities. I think a lot of the car designers that I've seen and interviewed and employed are a little bit bored, frankly, with, you know, designing the next supercar or the next SUV. You know, they want something that is challenging that can improve society. And I think that's, you know, we're not about making massive claims about being, you know, arrogant enough to say we're going to change the world. That's not what we're about. There is a kind of humble attitude to what we do. But it does feel that at the heart of what we do, it has the potential for, you know, big transformative change in the way that we live our lives and the way that we, particularly, you know, in a sort of post-COVID world when we're, I know you don't want to mention COVID, but when we're, you know, heavily reliant on delivery vehicles, for example. You know, this is an industry that is only going to go one way as more and more of us shop from home. So having the opportunity to reframe all of that and to design for a new paradigm is been something that I think a lot of those traditional automotive designers have really felt quite excited about. Yes, it's not the most glamorous product. You know, a van and a bus, you know, on the surface of it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that you're going to get excited about. But actually, when you drill down to the improvements that can be made through great design on these vehicles and these services, that has the ability to transform people's lives. And that, I think, is the thing that excites us.
Speaking of the transformation of lives, is that also the reason why you guys went to London? Because, you know, this kind of mega city is probably the best kind of growing place for a company such as Arrival, especially when we talk about commercial vehicles. It could have probably been easily also been Moscow, like, you know, if you go if you come in from a Dennis perspective, Tokyo, maybe even New York. But it probably had to be this kind of mega city, right? Otherwise, you know, to really experience these kind of changes and implementing them also. And I think your first client was actually the Royal Mail, which kind of supports that kind of argument as well, to be in the big cities to kind of implement as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I mean, we're fairly agnostic in terms of which city we're in. I mean, we're in, I can't remember at last count what how many cities we actually have offices in, but we, you know, we those that you mentioned, Moscow, St. Petersburg, London, all over Europe, we have Berlin, we have offices focus on various different aspects of the business, particularly software, for example, is based out in Petersburg and Moscow. Our R&D and engineering is based in Banbury and in London. I mean, we tried basing the main kind of operations, if you like, in the heart of the automotive world in Banbury, in Oxfordshire, in Banbury. But the sort of people that we were drawing didn't, I guess, align with our ideals and our culture. You know, we were getting a lot of contractors from traditional OEM automotive, and they kind of just wanted to do things in the way that they'd already done them, and that wasn't very aligned with where we wanted to be. So moving the HQ, if you like, to London, meant that we could tap into that culture of design thinking, that design led approach. So we were able to draw people from, you know, the best design consultancies in the world who were based out in London. A lot of the engineers who kind of wanted to think that way were congregating in that sort of those sort of busier metropolis, if you like. And so, yeah, the idea that we focused our main R&D centers in major cities was, again, more of an organic process rather than a decision make, you know, a concrete decision.
From your perspective, you know, as the CDO, you have the product in front of you, and then it becomes something as big as a vehicle. How did you adapt of like the development of a vehicle? I mean, like, you know, you can always break it down if you know the process. Everything starts with, you know, a creative process. This can be a sketch. This can be, you know, a research trip, whatever you can think of. And then you usually build like a 3D model, and then you do like, you know, in the car industry, you do like a quarter scale clay, or you might be doing something in VR and all these kind of things. How did you adapt to the size from your own personal perspective? Because I could imagine that's probably one of the hardest ones.
Yeah, I mean, there's a phrase, don't try to boil the ocean. And I think that probably stands us in good stead. You know, when you talk about the size, you're talking about the complexity of it rather than the physical.
Yes, yes, yeah, of course.
So the idea that, you know, when we first started, we were designing concepts for a van, a bus, a car, or whatever that might be. And it's one product, you know? So we start off small. We start off, in the traditional sense, we start off gathering all those user insights and then developing sketches and models and CNCing foam models and alias sketch models and into VR and establishing all of the kind of standard protocols, if you like. And we can do that with a relatively small team, especially, again, coming from an industrial design background where actually, you know, most of that alias work can be done by one or two people. We don't need it, 30 people just focusing on wing mirrors or hubcaps, you know. So we had a very lean, agile team working very closely with the experience team and with the engineering team and with the software team. And then very, again, organically, that process started to distill itself into the various categories that make up a vehicle. So, you know, the steering wheel became a project. The driver's seat became a project. So out of that one concept, we suddenly got 100 projects. And that's when you start to scale the team and you build the various different skill sets that you need to, you know, articulate that vision, if you like. And we identify when we need to bring people in. Now, I think one of Dennis's geniuses is not to grow the team too quickly before we needed to. You know, we made the mistake in the early days of hiring people that actually spent probably, you know, a lot of their time twiddling their thumbs thinking, why am I here? Because the time wasn't right to put them in place. So that organic growth and understanding when is the right time to develop aspects of a project and when to spin out various parts of that project into separate projects was kind of at the heart of, I guess, getting your head around the ambition of the business and the scale of the business. And that isn't just the vehicles that we're designing, by the way. We are designing everything. We are looking at all of the components under the floor of the vehicle that you would never see. They're being given the same level of detail and attention as the rest of the vehicle. So all of our components that we're designing are vertically integrated into the entire process. So whereas an OEM will rely heavily on Tier 1 suppliers and try to sort of cobble all of these components into something that resembles a neat package, regardless of the form factor, we were able to start with that blank sheet of paper and understand what the form factor needed to be to populate a flat floor skateboard. So that these are the sort of the thought processes that we went through right at the beginning to really understand what the future of designing a vehicle for today would look like. I guess is more akin to, say, the approach that Apple would take in designing a product. You know, you take the lid off a Mac and everything is beautifully designed, and they're not just designed like that to look good. They're designed like that so that the form factor can be packaged in the slimmest, smallest possible grid, if you like, that enables the end product to be as elegant and as simple as it is. And that's very much our philosophy.
That's very interesting. And obviously, like, you know, this, everybody knows Apple design and they know how lean they were as well, yeah, in their kind of setup of, especially the industrial design team. How do you make sure that the collaboration between the physical product, you know, which is super exciting for a lot of people because they see something, you know, and all, you know, it's something that you can touch, of course, is on the same level, and, you know, the interaction between the teams, between the physical team and the digital team, are kept to the highest standard? Because, you know, from my personal experience, when we look into the car industry, but not generally just there, but also in like smaller products as well, and this is what also makes Apple so great, is that it's almost like the perfect balance of the haptical product as well as the digital product that comes with that. And I think in particular in what you're trying to achieve, this kind of, let's call it an ecosystem where the car, or like the van or the bus, is a part of, but this ecosystem needs to be then in, you know, in full collaboration with the product and vice versa, of course, as well. How do you manage that? How is that working from a creative process? Because that's, you know, instead of 100 projects on the physical side, that probably easily goes up to like 1,000 projects in total, with all the complexity comes in.
I mean, a lot of this has come from Dennis's vision. You know, Dennis is, I don't want to draw comparisons, but I guess, you know, if you work for Steve Jobs, it would be a similar approach where there is almost this kind of obsessive level of attention to detail, and that filters through the entire business. I mean, it's wonderful for me as a designer to have a CEO that questions everything I do. Pushes me further, and he doesn't do that with me. He does that with everybody across the business, and that philosophy, that mindset, has trickled down through the various levels of management and through the hires that we have made. You know, these are fundamental parts of the individuals that we hire. That they have to have that mindset. They have to have that focused, that honed attention to detail across everything, whether that be, you know, the software, the hardware, the overall service, the brand, the packaging, the way that we sell our products. You know, all of these things are part and parcel of the design process. It's not just about, you know, it's not again, to use another phrase, it's not lipstick on a pig. We're not about just styling things for the sake of it. We're designing every aspect of all of our services and all of our products. And as soon as once you get that drilled in, and once you hire people who have that same thought focused process, then the rest of it kind of falls into place, you know? Yeah, you can't make assumptions about what the end result is going to be at the beginning of the process. You just have to go with it, and you have to believe in the people that you've hired, that they are going to, yes, make mistakes, but they're going to be able to get back up and, you know, get back on the horse and carry on. And I think that's says a lot about the people that we've hired, is that we have made a few kind of, you know, false starts, and we've torn it up, and we've started the process from scratch again. You know, the beginning of the formation of Arrival was a little bit like the formation of a new landmass. You know, there was a lot of volcanic activity, should we say, around you know, project meetings, and a lot of lava was flowing. But eventually, you know, that landmass solidified, and we've started to get some green shoots, and we are creating now products that are really aligned with all of those early visions that we had as a leadership team.
How long did that take you to get to that, you know, own comfort of saying, like, we feel comfortable now that we know what we are? Because I can imagine, like, you know, with these conversations very early on in the beginning, it's a definition phase, of course, as well. It's like, when did you all feel like, okay, now this is exactly what we want to do? How long did that take?
I think it would, I'm probably around 2 years, I would say. I think when we started to see the fruits of our initial thoughts, and also the sort of people that we were hiring, you know, the caliber of people that we were getting, people were really genuinely excited to join us. And these are guys, you know, we had roboticists from NASA who wanted to join us. You know, these are smart people who could work anywhere, but they identified Arrival as being a company that was wanting to change the zeitgeist, if you like. Wanted to do things differently. And I think that resonated with a lot of people. And you know, the time that we're in, that kind of transition period between combustion engine to electric or hydrogen or whatever the fuel cell that wins out in the end, if you like, that was something of a break point, I think, for a lot of people. People started to think, actually, there is a different way. We don't have to just have a linear production line. We can start thinking about, you know, these micro factories, and we can start making a difference in how vehicles are produced and that, you know, and recycled at the end of their life. And all of these things, I think, fed into creating an overall belief that what we were doing was the right thing, and the path that we were on was the right one. And I would say, yeah, 2 years before everybody was on the same page.
What is your main competing field right now? You mentioned already in the beginning, already it's probably not the traditional kind of car industry, but, you know, my interpretation of what's happening right now, and if I look into the bigger cities or, like, you know, some projects that I have been involved recently, is that the importance of the cities or counties or, you know, whatever you want to call it, but, you know, areas that control parts of the transportation process nowadays, it might be with buses and trains and all these kind of things. In London, we will have TfL. In Germany, we have different kind of systems. But could they become a little bit of your, not just only a partner, but also a competition? Because I would feel like, you know, the big Volkswagen commercial vehicles and stuff like that, like, yeah, you know, they are there, they've always been there, but technology wise they're really not on the same level as you're right now. Whereas with the cities and, let's say, their ambition and also their political ambition, that could be something a little bit different and also challenging.
Well I think we're working very closely with those cities. I don't necessarily see the cities themselves, you know, being the competition. There are other operators that are clearly, you know, looking to develop, particularly, you know, in the case of the bus, for example, there are other operators who are wanting that same piece of the pie. But I think the offering that we have, being such a ground up design. You know, I mean, for example, take an existing bus manufacturer who's trying to get into that same market and is trying to own that same part of that ecosystem. Is unless they start with that ground up approach, they're not going to be competitive, because their initial rationale is to put all the batteries and all the air conditioning, et cetera, in the roof, and that means that one of the key aspects of our user experience in the bus is being able to look up and see fresh air. We've got this entire glass roof. So all of those aspects of the user experience, the weight of our vehicles, the engineering that's gone into creating a completely flat floor, unless you start from that complete ground up clean sheet of paper, you're not going to be able to compete. I don't want to make claims that we can't that we're better than all these guys. We're not. We're able to just reinvent it from without the legacy. So we don't have the legacy of a traditional business. But in terms of competition from cities, all we're seeing is positive vibes coming from everybody we speak to. Who doesn't want a cleaner electric future at the moment? This is something that isn't a hard sell. Obviously, what we need to do now is deliver on that promise.
I agree, and I think the delivery is one of the toughest things to do. I mean, we've seen that with hundreds of companies, and not just in any kind of mobility or transportation sector. This goes down to everything. There's a lot of positive talk, but it seems like from what you guys have shown so far, you're on the right track. And before we come to an end, obviously you will get three questions as everybody coming onto the show. But I want to ask you something. You've been with Arrival for, pretty much since the beginning. What was the toughest project you've done? If you're allowed to talk about it, of course, that is, of course. But what was something where you were like, well, this could be really difficult if we can make that. But then in the end, the push was there that you say like, whoa, this was fantastic. Because in a short history of a company, a lot of stuff happens, but there's usually these one or two, moments where you just like, this was game changing for us.
I think it's the as I say, the level of vertical integration that we're striving for. It's not any one product itself. It's not the van, it's not the bus, it's not our gearbox, it's not our motors. It's about how we combine all of those and create a fully modular system, and then manufacture it using robofacturing. We've not really touched on our manufacturing processes and how we're looking at completely reconfiguring how we build body systems, for example. I mean, that was a massive challenge, and we knew early doors that we were never going to be able to compete with billion-dollar suites of tools that are amortized over a seven-year period to stamp out aluminium body shells, because we knew the market would be changing too quickly for us to do that. We didn't want to do that. So actually engaging in that process, and one of the holy grails of the automotive industry, which is redefining how you build bodies, how you make a body system, what do you make it out of, was something that we set ourselves the challenge of. And we brought in an amazing materials expert, Rob Thompson, who heads up that team. So integrating all of that into the process, and as well as how do you assemble these vehicles purely using automated robots in small micro factory cells rather than production lines. All of these things are the challenges. So I wouldn't say there was any one particular aspect of it that was challenging. It's bringing all of those pieces of the pie together to create this product ecosystem that we're striving for. That's the big challenge.
Well, in all kind of cases. By the way, when are you guys supposed to bring out the first bus or van? When's the first proper rollout, when the people can see it on the street as a finished product?
I'm going to have to defer to our sales and marketing team on that one. But we are working towards next year for delivery of our first vehicles to UPS, for example. They will be still at prototype level.
Okay, cool. And where can we find them? Is that clear already? Are they going to be in the UK, or are they going to be in the US? Is there any word on that already, where we can see them on the street?
Certainly the UK and the US are the two main markets that we're targeting. But yeah, we've got a lot of inroads into many of the local city authorities across the world. So I wouldn't just hold us to those two cities.
Okay, so before I let you go, three questions that every guest on the podcast gets. Two of them are very general when it comes to design, so you will not have to focus on anything. One of them is a car question, but it's going to be the fun car question. Question number one, which project that you have not been part of in your career would you have absolutely loved to participate in? This could be anything you want.
I think, and again, this is playing on my industrial design background, I think it would probably be the original iPod. And not just because of the physical product, but because of the user experience and because of the complete paradigm shift in how we now consume music because of that product and the service that was attached to it, i.e. iTunes. So thinking of the entire, again, this ecosystem that the product was at the heart of, must have been really exciting to have such an impact on consumer behavior and to, as I say, change that way we consume music, all through the physical interactions with a beautiful object. I think, you know, it doesn't get better than that.
Yeah, and also, of course, changing the buying behavior that comes with that. I think, you know, it's not just about, you know, the product itself. It's about the software that comes with it, which was iTunes. But let's be honest, I think back in that day, a lot of people were legally downloading music as well. But having a legal kind of downloading place that where you can spend your money and you can, and I think the biggest change for me was the single song, that you can just buy one song of an album, you know, based on that. I mean, well, that was incredible.
Making the user experience so compelling and so good that people didn't want to download for free anymore, you know, off Napster or wherever, which was a frankly, you know, terrible experience. Not that I ever did it, of course, but you know, having that as a dashboard, if you like, to bring all of those pieces of that pie together and be able to download your music in such a you know, intuitive experience was a real game changer, and something that Apple obviously have always done.
Yeah, true. All right. Question number two. Which creative person, now this could be a designer, could be a businessman, anything, that you have or have not worked with or in your career, has had the most profound impact on your career?
Again, this is going to be another obvious one, I'm afraid, but it's Dieter Rams. You know, I struggle to think of somebody somebody else I could use as an example, but the integrity that he went about improving the products that he designed was beyond reproach. I mean, the 10 principles that he put in place are still as valid today as they were back in the 60s when he wrote them. I mean, you know, good design is as little design as possible I think it's our mantra at Rival. It's reducing a product to the essence of its simplicity so that it becomes so intuitive as to how you understand how you use it, whether that be the physical product or the service. That's something that I don't think anybody before Dieter Rams really had put to paper. You know, they'd not embodied that principle before. I mean, I think, you know, you look back at some of the Bauhaus architects, Walter Gropius and the like, and they were doing similar things with furniture and with architecture, but I think it took Dieter Rams to really hone all of that into one distilled set of principles that we still adhere to today.
Yeah. Have you seen the documentary on him from Gary Huswood? I think that sums him up very nicely. You know, also in his character and how him as a person. I think he captured it very nicely. To all the listeners, if you haven't seen that one yet, we'll link that into the show notes. But it's a fantastic little documentary about Dieter. All right. Last but not least, now this is the car question. If I give you a blank check, what car would you buy?
this is going to sound like a plug for our sister company, but I think it would be the new electric Mustang that Charge are building. You know, there's something about, and I was one of the detractors when Dennis first mooted this idea that we were going to take these classic cars and convert them to electric. I was thinking, that's sacrilege. Why would you want to do that? You know, we're not wrecking old Mustangs. You know, we're buying licensed body shells from Ford, and we are converting them, and we are building better vehicles out of it. And you can still get the, you know, the beautiful aesthetics of the original Mustang from it. I think on the flip side of that, it feels to me like a lot of cars, regardless of whether they're Ferraris or Maseratis or Bentleys, they feel like they're a bit of a relic at the moment. I don't, I'm a guy who's entrenched in this industry, so I'm bound to say that. But there aren't too many cars that excite me at the moment. You know, I love the form factor of those early cars, and you know, don't get me wrong, if somebody parked a Dino in my drive and said, "This is yours," I'd be over the moon. But there is something about what we're doing with you know, converting these amazing, you're getting the best of both worlds. You're getting a high performance electric supercar, and you're getting the aesthetics of a 60s classic.
And it's a trend in general. I mean, you know, this kind of, you see the retro modding, and you can always ask the question how far you can go. But look at the success of Singer, for example, that are of course rescuing a lot of old Porsches as well. I mean, they're completely rebuilding them pretty much.
Yeah, Daniel and bringing a big hand in that. Who designed our Robo Race vehicle? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, obviously, you know, Daniel is another very interesting guy that we can talk about at some point in the future, of course. But you know, he's not the traditional kind of car guy anymore, and I think he's very vocal about that as well. That he doesn't want to be that kind of person.
And I think a lot of that has been born out of his relationship with Dennis as well. I think he would admit himself that, you know, Dennis has really impacted on how Daniel sees the future of automotive.
I can agree, and like I said, I mean, you know, I'm a big fan still of old the old 60s and 70s cars and stuff like that. And yes, I do like the sound of a nice big V8, especially from the American ones. But the question is always just like, how can we preserve these kind of cars? You know, like if you look up in the next 50, 60, 70 years, and we really get to the point of where you have no more petrol that you can put into your cars because it's just not required anymore, and the petrol stations are not there, how are you supposed to run them? So we need to kind of find ways of preserving them for the long-term future, of course, as well. And I think, you know, what you guys are doing is, of course, you know, very from the ground up, because, you know, you get the full body shell and stuff like that, but this can be easily be adapted to older cars as well that might not be reproduced anymore and stuff like that. Just think about old Ferraris, you know, old Astons, those kind of things. I mean, the possibilities are endless in that sense. But all right, Jeremy, thank you very much for taking the time. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you giving us a little bit of an insight on Arrival.
Yeah, and pleasure was mine. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we can all say, and I can speak for a lot of our listeners, we're rooting for you guys to really push forward, because I personally think the products are super clean, they're super simple, and I personally do enjoy that a lot. And I'm really looking forward to finally see them on the street very soon. And yeah, keep on pushing, and you know, keep on challenging everybody that's around you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.